Hey everyone, welcome to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm your host, Brenton Bickerstaff, and joining us this week on the show is James Van Auken. James is the director of Atlantic University, where he teaches courses such as Listening and Dialogue, The Inner Life, and Becoming a Teacher of Meditation. James is also the chair of the Leadership Curriculum Subcommittee at Atlantic University, and he also teaches a course on dream and meditation at the Cayce Riley School of Massotherapy. His ongoing goal is to seek out the wisdom available to us through a variety of spiritual traditions and apply it to the practical nature of everyday life. He has a Master's of Business Administration from St. Leo University, a Bachelor's of Arts in Religion from American Public University, and James had the unique experience of being raised with the Edgar Cayce teachings. As many listeners may know, his father is John Van Auken. James is a mindfulness practitioner and leads workshops on mindfulness, emotional intelligence, and topics related to the application of spiritual wisdom in daily life. His new online learning e-group is entitled Mindfulness in Practice, Bringing Meditation into Your Daily Life, and this runs from August 14th to September 10th. Hope you guys enjoy my interview with James Van Auken. And I'd like to start with maybe a little bit about your background with Atlantic University.
Oh, sure. I came over to Atlantic University 3 years ago, at the very beginning of 2010. I came over to help the university move its entire curriculum from a CD-ROM format, a distance correspondence format, to completely online. And we actually made that transition in about 4 months.
Oh,
which
wow.
It was pretty impressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it took a lot of effort by everybody, and the faculty were really good at it. That worked really well. At the same time, I was finishing up my master's in business administration, and I decided to do my final project on Atlantic University, and the final project was strategic management. So I spent about 2 months just going through Atlantic's history, its finances, its marketing, its strategies, the accreditation levels, the constraints from accreditation.
Right.
And put together a whole strategic plan, and I submitted it. And it wasn't soon after that that Kevin Tedeschi, the CEO, said, you know what, I want you to do this plan. And so he shifted my job, and I became the educational business manager. And at the same time, since I had a master's degree, I joined the faculty as well. I was the business manager till this January, when I was appointed as interim director of the school, and then this past May became the formal title. Interim was removed. So it's been an interesting journey here.
Yeah, wow. It's all happened so fast. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I know you mentioned that you've become a teacher at Atlantic University. You want to tell us a little bit about what courses you've taught there and what have you taken away from being a mentor at Atlantic University?
Sure. You know, it was a very humbling experience at first, to be brought on faculty and get to actually teach courses. It was something I had always kind of dreamed about. I had thought of it. I used to talk about it with my wife. Being like a faculty member at a university would be like an awesome retirement job. And then this thing just came out of nowhere. And I taught, the first course I taught was called Religion, Spirituality, and the Transpersonal. And it was a course that hadn't been taught in a long time, and they needed somebody to revise it.
Mm-hmm.
And although I only have a bachelor's degree in religion, I really, really enjoy the subject, and I read books on it, world religions, and study up on it. So I put the course together and started teaching it, and I just loved it. The students at Atlantic University are just so hungry to jump into the material and devour it. And it's like the more you can throw at them, the better. And they just want you to keep it coming. So it really is it's a great way from my perspective, it's a great way to grow because they want more. So it requires me to go out and find more.
Right.
So grab an old ancient text and add that into the class lesson. And it was a lot of fun. That was the first one I taught. I moved over to teaching some of the leadership courses after that, the Intro to Leadership course that included conflict transformation. I also taught a course on listening and dialogue, which was excellent. That class, it really has some great jewels in there. I mean, for example, like four blockages to listening. One of them is judgment. So if you were listening to me and you started judging the things I was saying, you've kind of stopped listening to it. You're focusing now on the judgment.
Right.
Or advice giving. You know, maybe you're listening to what I'm saying, but then you're thinking about how you could help me out. And then you've shifted again from listening to formulating thoughts. And the others are defending, you know, defending your own versus the other person. And then my favorite is the Me Too syndrome, which is, you know, we all use it socially and it's fun. It keeps conversations going, but it is a distraction to the listening component because you're kind of hijacking the conversation. As soon as you say Me Too and tell your story,
right?
You begin talking. It's important to use your, you know, social skills of observing. What has that person done? Are they okay with me?
Right.
I switched to a core class, which was great because the core classes are always full of students. I switched to a core class that was originally created by Henry Reed.
Mm-hmm.
And this course is called The Inner Life.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about dreams, meditation, and personal mythology. And creativity is kind of threaded and woven through that whole thing. That was an excellent course for me to teach and really helped me grow in a lot of ways, especially with the dreams. It was when I was preparing to teach that course, I saw that it was going to become available and people had given me a nod to go ahead and take it.
Mm-hmm.
Teach it. I really wanted to brush up on my work and knowledge with dream interpretation and this whole dream quest. In that course, we use Henry Reed's text, and we use this whole philosophy that Edgar Cayce created. That's in the doing comes the understanding. And so, if we start a dream quest and we get a dream, the most important thing is what we do about it. And so he created this journaling exercise, you know, and all week we're trying to incubate dreams and then find one that we believe is answering our questions, and then we act on it. But every time that we do dreams, people always want a lot of work on dream interpretation. So I knew I needed to brush up on that.
Right.
And, I mean, as most of our listeners will know, my father's John Van Auken. He taught me quite a few things from the Edgar Cayce principles as I was growing up, and he was an excellent dream interpreter. But you know, there's that element of like relying on somebody else to do the interpretation. I knew that when I was going to teach the course, they would be relying on me potentially. So it was Joseph Campbell who actually helped me to figure out how to interpret dreams on my own. Joseph Campbell is the expert on mythology, who's written numerous books. And
right.
What I started to recognize is that the way he was teaching people to understand mythology was actually exactly what we would need to learn how to understand our own dream. He started talking about things like the perennial philosophy.
Right.
And the idea of nature versus man-made things. And that dreams and mythology speak in that language, the language of symbols, the natural world. And a fun example is a goose. Let's say there's a goose in your dream.
Mm-hmm.
And our rational thinking would say, well, I'm not really sure why it was a goose. I mean, geese, in Virginia Beach, they come around part of the year. They hang out on all the golf courses. They, you know, there's not much to them. But if you mm-hmm. think in the natural world and ask yourself, what can a goose do? I mean, why would a goose show up in a dream? If I think about it in terms of what a goose does, a goose can fly through the air, it can walk on land, and it can float through the water.
Mm.
So if I think natural world, that is able to pass through the three realms of land, air, and water.
Right.
And then it starts to have a deeper level understanding there, a significance that our rational mind might not be able to pick up on. And as soon as I started seeing that from Joseph Campbell, I was like, this is dreams. This is it. So that was fun. I mean, as you can tell, I like to challenge myself when I'm teaching a course to grow and to think and to be prepared. And the students encourage that. It really is a reciprocal relationship.
Yeah, that's great. I'm sure the students appreciate that, too, to see how involved you get and know that, you know, it's a feedback. You guys are all kind of in this together, even though you are, you know, you are the teacher, the mentor. You guys are very much tackling everything, growing and learning together, which is nice.
Yes. I'm actually creating a course right now called The Practice of Self-Leadership.
Nice.
It's been a long time coming.
And we'll be right back with more from James Van Alken here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. And welcome back to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We'll get right back into my interview with James Van Alken.
But that's a lot about incorporating mindfulness practices alongside this element of being a leader.
Mm-hmm.
It's like cultivating your presence, recognizing your own sense of duty, but also the emotions and the feelings and everything that you're currently experiencing, and learning how to manage those.
Wow, that sounds like a great course. Look forward to that.
Yeah, I'm excited about it.
Yeah, so other than developing that course, what do you see going on at AU right now? Maybe anything exciting in the works?
Oh, certainly. There's always something going on behind the scenes, whether or not people can see it or not.
Right.
We're bringing on new faculty members all the time to come in and take over old courses and revise them and present them, or create a new course and add them to the curriculum. So there's a lot of that going on. A brand new thing that we have that is for this fall, so it's available now, you can register for it, is a brand new graduate certificate. And for those who don't know, a graduate certificate is basically what somebody would take after a bachelor's degree, but it's not a master's degree. It's much shorter.
Okay.
So it doesn't take as long to get, but you're taking master's level courses. And the graduate certificate is in integrated imagery regression hypnosis.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So students will be learning actually past life regression. And we've got a great new faculty member who's actually a graduate of Atlantic University and has a PhD in psychology concentrated in transpersonal psychology from Sophia University out in California.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, she's a wonderful person. We're very happy to have her. Her name's Deborah Smith.
Great. For those who may not be familiar with mindfulness practices, I know we've mentioned that quite a bit. Can you give a brief overview of what exactly mindfulness entails and how you can apply it in your life?
Sure. Mindfulness, in a nutshell, is present moment awareness. But there are certain components to it, especially adding in the component of non-judgment. So it's not about going, oh, I'm an idiot. Like, I can't believe I did that. It's, oh, I'm noticing that I made a mistake and I'm feeling frustrated that I did that. That's an example of mindfulness. So it's about cultivating awareness of the present. Sanskrit, it's smriti, S-M-R-I-T-I, which simply means to remember. Chinese, there's two symbols, one on top of the other. The top symbol is now, and the bottom symbol can either be interpreted as mind or heart. In the Chinese philosophy, the mind is in the heart.
So right.
It means that's why it's the same thing. But it's like the now mind and remembering. So, you know, an example I like to give to people is, you know, when we're experiencing something a little more difficult, we're almost completely engaged with the feeling of that difficulty. It's like we are that emotion. We are mm-hmm. that feeling. We are those thoughts.
Right.
So much so that, you know, everybody notices, what's wrong? How can I help?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have to work it out. The mindful awareness is actually being able to take a mental step backwards and simply observe it. it's almost like making it, it's like, don't take it personally, just
right.
observe it as
right.
if it was your friend. You know, it's like this ability to take care of ourselves, to see, you know, this life and these circumstances and really actually engage on a higher level that says, you know, it's okay. This is life. It's hard, you know.
Yeah. It reminds me, maybe something listeners might be familiar with is kind of the westernized version of just counting to 10 that your mother tells you when you're growing up, you
right.
know, rather than being reactive and shooting at the hip and losing your cool on everything, just, you know, take a second to reevaluate before you react to things.
Right. It's like Viktor Frankl wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning, and this man had been in many concentration camps and said, between stimulus and response, there is space. And that space is what makes all the difference. Between just doing the automatic response and actually actively choosing how you will proceed. So, you know, there's a lot of neuroscience in all of this too, and I don't know much about neuroscience, but I do know that we have some real wiring that is designed to save us out in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
And that can trigger and supersede the executive part of our mind. So
right.
if we have a stimulus that we perceive as a serious threat, it can hijack our entire executive thinking center. I mean, it's designed to save us, but we don't necessarily need that, you know, in a board meeting. You know,
right.
we need to be able to choose how we're going to respond.
Right. You may perceive your boss or coworkers as attacking you like something out in the wild, but they're not.
Right.
They're not. We don't need that anymore.
Right.
Yeah. And I know you're becoming very, very well known around the ARE for your mindfulness workshops that you've been incorporating at some of the conferences. I've had the pleasure to attend one myself, and it's such a phenomenal, unique experience that a Westerner doesn't necessarily get exposure to, because it is an Eastern practice by tradition.
Right.
What has been your favorite part about sharing these mindfulness practices and seeing people who had no idea what mindfulness was to see them get to practice it?
I didn't know you came to one. That's great.
Yeah, I went to the, it was when Swami Priyananda and Sister Mukti came. Yeah, I was actually, I was volunteering, but I was in the back, so that's why you probably didn't notice me.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of my first big ones. I think I had a 3-hour spot.
Yeah, that was awesome. I loved it.
The greatest thing for me about getting to teach it is that, I mean, mindfulness opened up my mind in a way that helped me at a very crucial point in my life, and getting to teach it and I don't know, bring it to other people. It's just, there's a sense of real fulfillment there.
Right.
And like just knowing that I'm going to teach it makes me practice it and live it.
Right.
So it's like this reciprocal relationship that I feel like I have to give back, and by creating opportunities to give back, it reinforces my personal practice.
Right.
So I think it's just incredible how that works, and I mean, it's something I want to keep doing forever.
And for somebody who hasn't had the pleasure to attend one of your mindfulness workshops, could you give a brief overview of what you guys do throughout the workshop?
Sure. I usually like to talk a while, you know, like we just have, about concepts and life
right.
in general, and dealing with the ups and downs, the peaks and valleys. And depending on the audience, you know, that's I'll come with the context of who I believe the audience is and where they're coming from. But then I'll get into doing some more formal practices. You know, we can talk theory for a while, and we can start to like drop into that understanding and that present moment. But the real practice is about attention training and teaching ourselves how to redirect our attention to, for example, become more aware of simply the sounds that we're hearing. So
mm-hmm.
it's a more formal practice in attention training. We do those in a sitting meditation, typically,
mm-hmm.
the formal practice. So might start with paying attention to breathing, seeing if we can solely focus on the sensation of breathing in the body, like noticing, I mean, you could try it right now, like just seeing where you feel it while you're breathing. Usually you feel it in one of three places, like your belly, your abdomen, your chest expanding and contracting, or like in your nostrils or the upper part of your lip.
Right.
And allowing that to be kind of an anchor to the present moment, because we are constantly breathing. And so by bringing full attention to the breathing, we are now dropping into the present moment.
Right.
And it's developing our concentration, our ability to direct our attention specifically to one object. And it becomes challenging, and we'll notice that we might have an itch. So there's a bodily sensation that stirs, and we acknowledge it and move back to the breath. Or maybe, you know, we're doing it in an auditorium, and there's a door slam over in the distance, and people, you know, jump a little bit out of their seat, noticing the sound and redirecting back.
Right.
So that's the element of the concentration training. Then after we've developed more concentration, we'll move more to a mindful awareness practice. So we might, you know, take the temperature of our feelings, our emotions. You know, what's the weather like today for us internally?
I like that.
Yeah. What thoughts are bubbling up? Are they random? Are they planning? Are they memories? You know, there are only so many things that can bubble up while we're just paying attention. And after a while, we start to recognize the nature of the mind. And instead of it being the master, we start to master it. There is
right.
a level of awareness where we can sit above that and observe. Otherwise, we're being run by our mind. That's one of the formal practices. We also practice a mindful walking or walking meditation, which is very similar. And I think it's very helpful for times when we're dealing with more difficult emotions. The idea is that we just pick an area that we're going to walk, and we walk slowly and purposefully, bringing full attention onto the sensation of walking, what it feels like to walk, and noticing the thoughts, because at first it may seem bizarre, and that's a thought, an observation,
mm-hmm.
and a judgment. And we go back to it. And after a while, there's just this like calm abiding that starts to show up of just enjoying the present, you know, recognizing that there's nowhere I have to go. There's nothing I have to do at this moment, and to really be able to just enjoy it. I think it was, I probably will say this name wrong because I always read it and I don't hear it, but I think the name is Blaise Pascal. This is a poor paraphrase, but if we could all learn how to be alone in a room for an hour.
And we'll be right back with more from James Van Alken here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. And welcome back to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We'll get right back into my interview with James Van Alken.
I mean, our problems would be so minimal.
I agree.
The quote is much grander. It's like,
yeah, but you get the idea.
Right. Like all of humanity's problem is that no one knows how to sit in a room alone for an hour. This, you know, but these practices, like I said, they're formal. So we're not doing this, you know, walking down the street. These practices are teaching us how to just be, you know, human beings instead of human doings.
Right.
And it's quite profound when we actually try it. And these are the things we do on retreat.
Yeah. And I remember the food one was really nice too, because I remember the food and the walking were the, you know, I talked to a lot of people after the workshop, and those were the two that were really stuck with them and really had an impact on them. Number one, the beauty of this is it impacts them immediately. Just having this mindfulness practice, something that they haven't been exposed to, there's an instant gratification, an instant effect on them on, you know, a very deep level, because this is a very profound practice that can really shift things in your life. And I know, remember the eating of the raisin, and just to eat very slowly or to walk very slowly, things that you never do throughout your day. You don't take the time to really chew and taste the food, and, you know, we just shove it in and swallow it. And when we're walking somewhere, we're just walking to get somewhere, to get from A to B. There's no real paying attention to the steps and the sensations.
Right.
So people were loving that, and the reaction was phenomenal. So I hope you keep that up.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you made some good points there. The first, I mean, it's a natural thing. It's not that bizarre to try to just pay attention to one thing that we naturally do.
Right.
And the second is, it's really kind of like waking up to our life,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the simplest way. It's not an easy practice, but in the simplest way, it's just about enjoying the small things, enjoying, mm-hmm. or the seemingly small things. It's amazing to just be alive, but to recognize that we're alive is tremendous. You know, and many of us have faced death or have had loved ones pass on, and it takes something like that for us to recognize the tremendous value of life. And, you know, that only lasts for so long, too. It fades out. So these
right.
practices help us to just appreciate the subtle nature of living in the moment. It's a really cool practice.
It's really great. I've been working with it for years, and it's completely shifted a lot of things for me, and just it really just improves your quality of life, because it brings you back into the present now, which is something that's lost so much in you know, kind of these modern times where there's all these things trying to pull you in different directions. Just the simple things of just focusing on one thing and appreciating it is such an important practice.
Yeah. One of the teachers I recently attended a retreat with just really emphasized the point that we truly live in a world of constant partial attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's really not optimal. You know, and there have been many studies out. I've seen some studies from the Peter F. Drucker School of Management about how multitasking and this partialized attention is actually incredibly fatiguing to the managers, to the employees. You know, this idea that at any second you're supposed to instantly respond to an email, you might be in the middle of a project, a phone call as you take it, somebody walks into your office. You know, this constant partial demand of attention is actually less productive and more fatiguing. You know, and this, they emphasize it, attention training, you know, mindfulness practice. They call it attention training.
I'd agree with that 100%. Coming from my personal experience in the workplace, I work in a restaurant as one of my jobs, and it is extremely draining to have to multitask. But on the other side, you have a lot of people who have jobs that require them to multitask. They don't have a choice. And I think when you bring your mindfulness practices into a job where you have to multitask, it's amazing how it changes the job, because, yeah, you are multitasking, but you have that added focus where you can do one thing at a time. And you can do it well, you know, and even though you are multitasking, you have that focus that you get from mindfulness practices, which really, really helps in the workplace.
Definitely.
You're big into bringing mindfulness into the workplace. How is that? How have you seen that affect your personal life and your coworkers?
Oh, I think it makes all the difference. when I'm talking about bringing it into the workplace, I like to introduce the emotional intelligence information, which was, if people have heard of emotional intelligence, they probably heard of it through Daniel Goleman,
mm-hmm.
who wrote a few books on it. The two factors of emotional intelligence are, first, self-awareness. So we've already begun talking about that with mindfulness. But the second is self-management, the ability to, you know, maybe be aware that this coworker of yours is really frustrating you, or if you're working in a restaurant, this table of people is really frustrating me as a waiter. And then that's self-awareness. The self-management is to redirect your attention or choose how you plan to respond. And I swear that makes all the difference. I mean, for me, you know, as a manager, as a director, as a subordinate, and, you know, amongst my colleagues, my ability to become aware of how I'm feeling, especially if it's I'm disagreeing with something, or I'm feeling that level of intensity rise up, you know, maybe somebody's talking about something that really affects me or my job or my coworkers or the future,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's very important for me to manage that emotion and not be a victim of my emotional response.
Right.
And, I mean, I have a young daughter, and expecting another daughter in a few months.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. I mean, it is incredibly demanding to
absolutely
to be a new parent. I mean, we have a 2.5-year-old, and she's incredibly demanding on what she wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she's, as they say, the terrible twos, and she's wonderful, but incredibly demanding at certain times. just like all of us are. That's the self-awareness I recognize. I'm demanding for what I perceive as the optimal morning, you know, and so is my daughter.
Right.
Her optimal morning is for me to make pancakes and to play with her and to, you know, set this thing up so she can knock it down and put a puzzle, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So my ability to recognize I have the same thing going on with just different, you know, subjects and objects.
Right. Absolutely.
It makes all the difference. And also to notice times when, like, I'm just totally overwhelmed and be able to say that, you know what, I am overwhelmed right now. I cannot handle toddler world, or
right.
I cannot handle this customer or whatever, and to do something about it. Sometimes we need to talk to our spouses, talk to our coworkers, and say, look, I need your help. I cannot handle this one right now.
Right.
And that takes a lot to do, I'd say, you know, to be real about that, see your own limitations, and even ask for help.
Right. You know?
And really, it's important to state that the mindfulness practice is something that, like, it's called a practice. You have to do it all the time.
Absolutely.
And the key thing to remember is it's a non-judgmental practice. So if you have lost it and things have been frustrating and terrible and you haven't recognized it, you've just been in it, caught in that stream, as soon as you recognize the mindfulness component or the present moment, you're back in it.
Right.
It's important not to add the judgment.
Right.
Like, I've been a fool. No. Don't judge yourself. You're back in it. Present moment. Now. You know, here.
Yeah. You should give yourself a pat on the back for actually catching yourself rather than beating yourself up. You know, do the exact opposite.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, another teacher I saw said, sometimes just labeling, saying, you know, this is frustration. This is aggression. This is sadness. Just saying this is and labeling it allows us to have that space. You know, distance between being it and seeing it.
Right.
It's a very helpful little tip there.
And I think it helps you to be more compassionate and an understanding, which is, you know, anybody could tell you that there's more of that needed now more than ever.
Oh, yes.
Just to understand people and, you know, because a lot of times people are going to be who they are, and it's really what you're responsible for is your reaction to them. And, you know, taking responsibility for that mindfulness, there's really no better practice than mindfulness to take your, you know, the power back for your emotions and your reactions.
Yes. And it's important to, I mean, sometimes we talk about levels of control. There are only so many things I can control, and then
right.
only so many things I can influence, and then everything else, you know, I cannot control or influence. And we really need to start that with ourselves. If we can't control ourselves, I mean, how could we really control anything? That's the practice, self-management, you know, self-awareness, self-management.
Yeah, I think playing the victim becomes a reoccurring pattern in many people's lives, including myself, where you have to be mindful of, you know, am I blaming somebody else for what I could be taking responsibility for? You know, am I blaming somebody for the way that I'm feeling right now when ultimately I could, you know, figure out what I'm feeling right now and decide, you know, it's probably not the best for me to do this and kind of let it go and, you know, not be so attached to things, I suppose.
Yeah.
So how does meditation play into all this?
The formal practices are conducted in meditation. The idea that, you know, I mentioned earlier, we start with the breath, with the breathing, with centering, with focusing on the body, with, you know, taking the temperature, seeing the weather patterns, you know, so it is a meditative practice. And when we're comparing the mindfulness meditation to an Edgar Cayce meditation, there's a lot of things that we can pull out of the Edgar Cayce readings or highlight that are parallel with this. He talks a lot about how we set up personal barriers.
And we'll be right back with more from James Van Alken here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce.
He says you have to be aware of them. We have to promote self-awareness because self constantly meets self is what he says. If we don't recognize them and deal with them, they will just continue to show up over and over and over again.
Right.
And he says we need to learn to step back and watch self pass by. There we go. That's the same thing as taking a step back and observing. What are our actions? What are our behaviors? How am I feeling right now and why? There's a whole practice called insight meditation, also called Vipassana, V-I-P-A-S-S-A-N-A, which is meditation that is solely focused on turning toward whatever shows up. you know, instead of pushing aside or stepping on anything that shows up.
Right.
It's actually look toward this subtle emotion that might be in the background that we never really notice, but we know it's there. And looking at it and saying, why? Why is it there? What's here? What can I learn from looking at this? And if you look at it, turn toward it, like let's say sadness, and you start recognizing in your meditation, there's a level of sadness here. And ask yourself why. You might be able to go 3, 4, 5 layers underneath that to recognize that you're just bummed out about this one thing that happened a year ago.
Right.
You haven't really let go of it. And as
right.
soon as you own it and see it, boom, there's the insight. And now it's not an issue anymore.
Right. It's like taking the power back, you know, taking control of your life again.
Yeah. You know, I really feel like growing up with the Casey principles, one thing that seemed that has become a natural belief of mine is the idea of reincarnation and karma and grace.
Right.
You know, that I notice when I'm talking with some people who didn't grow up with that, you know, they kind of nod their heads, but, you know, it's a maybe yes or no. And I've gone through that myself, maybe yes or no. I mean,
mm-hmm.
in a sense, if there is reincarnation, how would we know? In another sense, I really do feel like I do know. And most people who have worked on themselves and done some of this inner life work start to recognize certain patterns, things that they can't explain, like
you right.
know, the idea of like Mozart being able to compose a symphony at 5 years old, or
right.
for naturally gifted young athletes, musicians, or whatever. You know, at some point we can't explain why so-and-so is drawn to Eastern martial arts and another
right.
person is drawn to, you know, the humanities or Greek philosophy so strongly that they'd be willing to devote their lives to it. So I guess growing up with that philosophy, it really made that seem like a very good explanation of why life is the way it is and why people have different situations. You know, so some fundamental or core, I should say, or mainstream is better. Some mainstream religions just have a certain explanation of why things are the way they are, and they just don't go deeper than that.
You know, right.
That's the answer. You don't have to worry about going deeper. I think the reincarnation, karma, and grace is the answer to the why things are the way they are.
Right.
I have a lot of respect for the people who are seekers and want to know the answers.
Absolutely.
Personally.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way I've been, and it's made all the difference to me.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the hallmarks of the Edgar Cayce material is the amount of information that if you are a seeker, it's just an incredible place to be.
Absolutely. Another
yeah.
great thing about it and the way the ARE is set up, it's like if you're interested in this one topic of the readings, go check it out. And if you're
right.
not interested in the others, it doesn't matter. It's
exactly.
not a one size fits all. It's a pick and choose what works for you.
Right.
You know, Casey was adamant that it not be a religion, that it not be, would not have any sort of like demanded structure. You know, where if you come here, you have to abide by all of these things. You know, you have to do the Casey diet. You have to believe in reincarnation. You have to practice meditation. You have
right.
to do dream work. No, he never said that.
Right.
Now, if he said, you know, when people asked him, how can I be more like you in terms of being able to be more intuitive and have more psychic awareness, that's when he said, if you want to have that, you can practice these things that would aid that, which is really, like I said, inner work life.
Right.
And this mind-body-spirit balance. But it doesn't mean that people can't show up here and research the health readings and not pay any attention to the readings where he was giving her people showing their past lives.
Right, absolutely.
That's one of my favorite parts about it.
Yeah, me too.
You can show up here and pick and choose what you care to learn about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I know Casey said that specifically about referring to the research part of the Association for Research and Enlightenment, where the research is done with you. You are the researcher doing research on yourself. You know,
right.
you find what you can out of the material that really draws you to it, and you know, you work with it. You put it into practice and see what it does for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next thing I've got coming up, if anybody's interested, is I'm doing an all-weekend workshop for the Casey Riley School of Massotherapy. That's August 3rd and 4th, Saturday and Sunday, from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. both days. And that's $275. You can sign up by going to edgarcasey.org and navigating over to the Casey Riley School and clicking Continuing Education. The topic is mindfulness and practice, bringing meditation into daily life. So that's more of like an immersion, a full
right.
weekend workshop immersion. And then for those of us who are busy and spread out all over the world, I'm doing an online e-group with the e-groups department on the same topic, mindfulness and practice, bringing meditation into daily life. And that's a four-week-long, one-month online group from August 14th to September 10th for $119. And that's where, you know, I'll put up online guided meditations and lessons, and then there's a discussion board where people can post what came up for them, and I see it and respond to it. So
that's
both
great.
Opportunities are a lot of fun.
Yeah,
also,
absolutely.
People are more interested in Atlantic University. We have our enrollment time open right now, and we're accepting applications if you're interested. Enrollment goes now through August 23rd. The classes begin September 9th and go through December 12th. And if anybody, you know, has a question for me or wants to send me an email, that's fine. My email is james.vanauken, V-A-N-A-U-K-E-N, at atlanticuniv.edu.
Well, that's all the time we have for the show this week. I want to thank my guest, James Van Auken, for joining us. And a big thank you goes out to all the listeners. I'm your host, Britton Bickerstaff, reminding you that each soul has a definite job to do here on Earth, but you must be the one to find and do that job. Have a beautiful week, everybody.